Welcome back to Looks Like New, the radio podcast of the Media Economics Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm Julie Martins, and this is the show where we ask old questions about new technology, exploring how the forgotten histories and overlooked voices of computing might help us reimagine our digital present. Today, we've joined by someone who's made it her life's work to excavate the stories that Silicon Valley would rather we forget. Our guest is Camila Gelas, an interdisciplinary artist, filmmaker, and researcher whose practice weaves together technology, history, memory, and storytelling in ways that challenge how we think about computing's past and future. Camila is perhaps best known as the co-creator and co-host of Our Friend, the Computer, a globally ranked podcast that has spent 3 seasons unearthing alternative computing histories, from Chile's socialist project CyberSyn to Japan's early smartphone revolution, from educational computers in New Zealand to women's appropriation of telephone technology. But her work extends far beyond the podcast booth. She's contributing editor at the Millennium Film Journal for experimental film, co-founder of the Super Killer Girls, a research collective investigating how women's labor has been tangled with microchip manufacturing, and founder of the Structured Knowledge, a consultancy helping creatives shape complex ideas into public-facing work. What makes Camila's approach so vital is how she refused to let technology be merely technical. Whether she's creating films, curating exhibitions, or digging through computer archives, she's always asking whose stories have been erased, what social histories are embedded in our machines, and how might remembering differently change what we build next? Her work has been supported by institutions from the New Museum to the Media Archaeology Lab right here at the CU Boulder, and it's challenging us to see every technology carries within it the dreams, struggles, and labor of people whose names we have never learned. Camila, welcome to Looks Like New. We are thrilled to have this conversation with you.
Thanks for having me and for that lovely introduction.
Camila, before we dive in, how do you like to introduce yourself and your trajectory? I know you move across so many different practices, artist, filmmaker, podcaster, researcher. So I'm curious how you describe the thread that connects all this work.
I guess I'm a research-based artist, but sometimes that doesn't really sort of contain everything that I do or is so specific enough. I studied painting originally and sort of moved through a few different creative spaces, including working in like Hollywood for a while. And after that experience, I started making video art. And for me, it was always about kind of understanding my own cultural heritage through my practice. So my dad is, I'm from Australia, but my dad is Chilean and was a political refugee. And so I'm sort of second generation of that heritage. And for me, like learning about myself was always through technology and through media. And it wasn't necessarily like through my own family. And so I started to think about how I was understanding myself and sort of the stories that I was being told, who the actual audience, intended audiences for them were, versus me sort of learning about like deep parts of myself through it. So I started to work on some projects that looked at technology. Particularly, I had a project called Hasta Carmen, which was about the geopolitics of the video game, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? But that was sort of a visual piece for the Cordite Poetry Review. And from that, I sort of started to excavate these sort of more technological media histories of Chile. And now that sort of expanded to other stories within sort of tech history. But it's all about how we understand ourselves through it, sort of who controls the sort of networks or the media that we're learning about ourselves in, what stories are being held within that, and maybe how we can expand that a little bit more to actually learn about ourselves or see ourselves in these spaces more fully rather than like filtered through other people's eyes and sort of expectations of audiences.
Awesome. And our friend, the computer, has covered everything from Soviet cybernetics to Brazilian video tech to Nokia's fashion phones. How do you choose which forgotten technologies to excavate? And what makes the computing history worth recovering?
Yeah, so Alpha and the Computer, we've done 3 seasons, and it's me and Anna Meisel. And we started that project because Anna has this amazing online sort of curatorial space called External Pages. And she commissioned me many years ago to make a work, and she coded that as well, which was incredible, that was about Project Cybersyn and sort of uses of computer networks before and after the Chilean dictatorship. And we both just got very excited about Project Cybersyn. Like it has the sort of, a lot of the content of that work is more current documentation of the social uprising. But yeah, this sort of framework we were using of Project Cybersyn, which is this socialist cybernetics project from the 1970s, early 1970s, that was trying to cyberneticize the whole of Chile, connecting the factories along the length of Chile through a sort of telex machine network. We just got very excited about it. And I think for me, it was one of the first times that I really realized that there were other types of networks before the sort of World Wide Web internet that we have. And Anna had been working on another project for somebody else that was looking at OGIS in the Soviet Union, which is a similar sort of network. And we were sort of comparing notes, and we started investigating more, and we found all these other networks. So I had done some radio sort of work in my younger years and was really eager to sort of think about podcasting and audio sort of production in sort of inside my practice, and sort of invited Anna to come on the journey. And she was an amazing collaborator for the 3 seasons. And so the first season is pre-internet networks, telex, teletext, and videotext networks. And we tried to find non-US stories. Sometimes we sort of reach in a little bit, but always stories that maybe are not part of that sort of traditional narrative. The second season was educational computer programs around the world. And then the third season was cell phones. But I think like where we started that project without being experts. And that was always how we approached every episode. We were just really excited about these stories. And so anything that we found exciting, we felt that the audience would find exciting too. And the way that we structure that podcast is that we talk to each other. And so one person will tell, we sort of alternate each episode who tells the story, and then the other person is kind of reacting to it. So we wanted it to be a very accessible podcast. And, you know, essentially it's sort of dense stories of industry, but we try to find, as we're going through, you know, we're finding the timeline and we're working it all out, but we try to find sort of the anecdotes and the trivia and the really interesting kind of funny stuff that's like in there that maybe is lost a little bit if you just look up the Wikipedia article about the network or about the program. So, you know, there were some episodes that we were creating, we're like, oh, it's not quite doing what we want it to do. But usually those choices are made based on kind of interest and what we ourselves found really interesting. I think by the end, we couldn't continue to say that we were not experts anymore. Not that we were experts, but just that we did know quite a lot. And we ourselves were building our knowledge through each episode in each season. So by the end of, say, the pre-internet network season, we like knew what teletext was, we knew what videotext was. And so I think when the audience listens as well, if they listen in order, they kind of come along that journey with us too.
Familiar and curious about it.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite episode?
I mean, I got very obsessed with Minitel, the French network that was sort of pre-internet. And we did 2 episodes on that. So we did a Minitel episode, and then we did a pink Minitel Rose episode, which is actually kind of like sexy chat rooms and sort of how it was used in that sense. But I because that was a big part of Minitel, but I love the object of the Minitel terminal. It's sort of connected to the telephone network, but it was around for a decade before the internet was around, like as we know it. And France actually got the internet, World Wide Web internet, sort of later than many other countries because they had Minitel and they were doing everything that you would, that the new internet was promising on a network that they were very like used to by that point because they'd had it for like 10 years. But people were banking, chatting in the chat rooms, they were booking tickets, sending emails, things like the equivalent of those things on the Minitel network for a decade before the internet was doing that.
We have some of those at the Media College Lab.
I love Minitel.
Those are super cool.
Yeah.
And you've said the podcast emphasized, you know, multiplicity and representation, diverse stories in tech history. And what do we lose when we only tell the canonical stories like the Apples, the Microsofts, the Silicon Valley origin myths?
We lose our own heritage and our own history and as individuals, that we have these sort of specific backgrounds. Countries have their own stories, their own initiatives. They're very sort of specific to different communities, and that kind of gets erased. But also I think that I'm very interested in sort of digital and historical literacy and the importance of continuing to sort of tell these stories, but also to be able to read the past. And I think if we look at the present, if you don't know about these histories, you're in the present, you think that this is sort of, you know, in an inevitable state that we're in and that the future will be built on where we are now. But really we've had a lot of different sort of pasts that we can build on. And just because something has sort of failed or ended doesn't mean it was a failure. Like often these initiatives and these programs or this technology fail, quote unquote, because of outside forces. That could be a coup, governmental. It could also be, a larger company sort of swooping in to another country and kind of taking over, say, like the educational computer space. And it's just that thing of like we're in a sort of, I don't know, point right now where we're making some decision. There's like new technologies coming in and we're deciding how we're going to use them into the future. But we have had these conversations many times before and I think it's worth revisiting. But it's also worth like making sure that all of these conversations stay in like our current conversation. Because otherwise we just think that we're in the sort of status quo of the current present time. But actually there's so much to learn from the past and we've done so much that gets really erased and forgotten because there's some people, organizations or networks or anything that have a sort of idea of what they want the future to be. It's easier to keep people on that path if they don't know all the other ways that we've already done it.
Yes, I always hold that so dearly, the importance of expanding our repository of experiences and narratives. It's just fundamental to understand with a lot of more nuance the reality we live in. And yeah, exactly, it is perfect. And your background spans filmmaking, visual art, and historical research, of course. But how does how does thinking like an artist change how you approach technology history? What can a creative practice reveal that traditional tech history might miss?
I think that creative practice is experimentation and that freedom. I really enjoy that I come to this from an artistic background and I work with academic institutions a lot and really enjoy it. I think it's very important. But I also have some freedom in particularly my creative work versus my research work that allows me to kind of play. And I often will sort of use, I'm like right now at the lab, I'm like harvesting fonts from really old computers and I'm going to redraw things and I can kind of play around. And it gives me some freedom to be able to do that and sort of put that next to something else. My work is very collage-y, both sort of... in the research sense that I pull all these different bits together to tell stories, but also in an aesthetic sense. And I can also be very sort of kind of speculative. I can make things up and to sort of think about the future. And I always come from a very deep research base, but then there's a point where I start to be able to play. And for me, that sort of creates these works that are way more experimental than if I'm like writing a paper. And also that then hopefully creates artworks or experiences, because my artworks are sometimes sort of interactive pieces, or, you know, paintings as well, that I think are an experience that allows viewers to engage with those thoughts and with that history in a slightly maybe easier way than, or less intimidating way than perhaps like reading an academic journal or going to a conference. So I'm often thinking about the audience in my work and sort of having different entry points, that if they just want to look at something, they can, and I hope that they get a lot out of that. But then I usually will also provide the research or provide a sort of essay or podcast episode or something else that goes alongside it. So if people come in and they're like, this is really interesting, what is Project Cybersyn? They can, I give them access to that if they want to sort of do that. So I really enjoy being able to make these sort of research creative works where there's like multiple ways for people to engage with that research. I used to find it quite annoying, I think, when I first started painting and I was working with research, but I felt like you couldn't see it in the final work. And obviously it informs the final work, but I wanted the audience in that conversation with me. So for me, that was why I started to create these sort of layered works that have the ability to engage on these different levels.
And spark people's curiosity.
Yeah.
That's awesome. One of your film projects, Vicino Vicino, explores neighborhood memory, and your work often deals with personal connections to collective history. How do you think about the relationship between individual memory and technological systems?
Yeah, so Vicino Vicino is, I'm basically unpacking a French TV documentary from the 80s that was about the group that my dad was fighting with. And I wanted to learn more about that group. And so I found this sort of like YouTube video that was the unedited footage. And so, and then I spent a very long time, like a year, trying to find the actual edited footage that was in this sort of French archive. And I learned about the group. And then I wanted to learn like what the piece was saying to me about the group versus facts. Because I realized that, yes, it's telling me like, oh, they did this and they did that. But the people in it were also performing for this French TV audience in a different way than if I were to learn it sort of firsthand. And so I unpacked this documentary, looking at the sort of the keywords in the archive itself, and then moving through sort of language mistranslation of French, Spanish, and English, and moved through to physical movement. So I was looking at how they were training in the forest, and I was re-performing those movements with my own body and my own sort of personal spaces, my studio, my house, over a sort of period of time, so a few different studios, a few different houses. And I wanted to sort of see where I sat within this story. So like my personal individual experience with my family watching this versus the audience, intended audience, which was a sort of large scope French TV news audience. But that piece is also about family legacy. It's about the sort of transfer of information across generations. And I think there's this thing of like, you know, this post-memory transfer of that sort of trauma and information and knowledge through the generations. But then there's also, what do you learn through media? And so I guess like for me, it's that juncture of understanding of like, what are you learning from the sort of media or through the networks that you're consuming it, that's actual sort of, well, factual information, versus what are you kind of absorbing? Who was the audience that this was intended for, and how does that change the messaging, and then what are you learning in connection with like your own history. So I'm always thinking about that and trying to unpack what is the actual thing that's happening here, who made it, what was the intention, who was the intended audience, and then who are you as a viewer, and like how do these things interact.
One of your film projects, Vicino Vicino, explores neighborhood memory, and your work often deals with personal connections to collective history. How do you think about the relationship between individual memory and technological systems? With Super Killer Girls, you're investigating how women's labor has been entangled with computing infrastructure, particularly in microchip manufacturing. Can you tell us about the Killer Girl and why understanding this history matters now?
Yes, I love Super Killer Girls. Super Killer Girls is my group at the moment with Lua Vollard and Anna Meisel. Anna, who I did the podcast with, we sort of founded it collectively last year, the year before, and we've been doing some work with the New Institute in Rotterdam. And so it's me, I'm artist researcher, Lua is a curator, and Anna is a creative curator. So we're sort of coming to it from these different angles, but we're looking at sort of women's labor in the history of tech manufacturing. But when we were at the New Institute, we spent some time in Nijmegen in Netherlands, that they have this sort of Philips semiconductor factory archive that's now housed in like an active rubber factory. And it's sort of tended to by volunteers, many of whom were workers at the factory, and then also some video artists. So it's a very cool space, and they have all of the like equipment and the like gold, like material sort of that they would use, and sort of photo albums of I don't know, events and marathons and stuff that everybody would go on, because it was kind of a factory town. And we were looking at women's roles within this, particularly because they were sort of advertised to because of their sort of delicate nature, I guess. They were seen as having sort of steady hands, that in a similar way to sort of craft work, handiwork, that they could kind of create these little sort of things that needed to be created for the microchips. So we were interested in how they were advertised to, for instance, instead of being, you know, like come work at the factory, it was like come work at the atelier, the studio. So it was, you know, essentially a very heavy sort of factory job, but it was framed in a very different way because they wanted a particular type of worker, which is this female, young female worker. So we're called Super Killer Girls because we discovered this term, the Killer Girl, which was from sort of early computing, so 40s, 50s, where a computer used to be a job. It was a person, like a secretary, for instance. It was a computer, a woman that does, usually a woman, that does manual calculations. And then when we shifted to sort of computing, that job went away. And in the same way that, say, horsepower is used to think about steam engines replacing horses, it was a Killer Girl was 1,000 hours of average women computing labor, which was now no longer a person. And so we've taken this term. It was a tongue-in-cheek term, but it is used. So we've taken this term and called it the Super Killer Girl. And we're thinking about ways to sort of, I guess, sort of reanimate or bring back the sort of physicality or knowledge of these roles within computing, and how that sort of role and also the understanding of that labor has sort of extended through to now, where that labor is very much not seen. And so we're looking at particularly sort of microchip technology. That sort of Lua is really leading that. She has a lot of expertise in that. I'm looking at switchboard operators, particularly Bell Telephone. I'm based in New York, so New Jersey, New York has the Bell Telephone network there. And then Anna is looking, she's based in London, in the UK, and she's looking more at sort of weaving history. So together we sort of, the powers of the three of us, of the Super Killer Girls, sort of come together through these different lenses, and we create projects, we do residencies, publishing projects, running workshops, thinking about, it's very speculative as well, thinking about how we could kind of understand this labor. We're working on a project at the moment called The Manual for Superfluous Motions, where we took lots of photographs from the archive at Nijmegen, and we are sort of imagining the movements of the hands and then thinking about the unwanted movements, because the unwanted movements were sort of the things that showed the humanity of the people, instead of they were just like part of the production line and they were sort of machines in this production line. The superfluous motions, the extra motions were seen as of noise and stuff to be very controlled. Often their lives were controlled as well in an effort to have their hands controlled. So we want to sort of take that stuff and create like a manual or a sort of, a sort of way of understanding. So it's also got some exercises and things to kind of play with motion. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely. Okay. It's fantastic. And on that same note, like, what patterns have you noticed in how women's contribution to computing get remembered or more often forgotten? And how does this erasure shape what we think technology is and how we think it's for and who we think it's for?
Yeah, I mean, it's almost always forgotten. There'll be occasional people that get sort of brought to the top and celebrated, which they should be. But you know, this sort of the labor of technology, it's not just women's labor. It's a lot of people's labor that gets unseen and untalked about. That, it's what built everything we have. And it was also specialized and, you know, sought out in very specific ways. And yeah, as we've kind of gone along, this labor has disappeared or it's been moved to other areas of production. I think a lot at the moment also about AI. I mean, there's the sort of, the Mechanical Turk, there's the, like, what is actually automated and what is sort of people behind the scenes doing the work. And it's really the way that everything is set out right now is the desire is that we don't see any of that labor. It's that we are just talking to an interface. And even if there's not a person behind that, there's always people behind it. And to kind of frame it in that way scares me a little, because as we build on that, if we keep going in that direction, it's just going to get more separated. I think there's also a risk with that in the same way that people don't really, well, some people nowadays don't even know where a file is stored or how to access things, that just makes that worse. And that also means that we don't feel autonomy over the technology around us, that we can't sort of fix things. We're sort of beholden to the corporations in many ways. And then also I'm sort of working on a project right now looking at advertising and women in the 80s with computers. But I'm thinking about like our relationship with computers, and in the 80s it was very much sort of the computer is the other. We're bringing it into our home. We have a relationship with it and we spend time with it, and then we don't spend time with it, and sort of thinking about that as well. And then that sort of changed, and the computer sort of became part of ourselves. It wasn't an other that we had a relationship with. It was part of our brain, our mobile phones that we carry everywhere. And now, though, with AI and the chatbot, ChatGPT, all of these things, we're going back to that relationship that we have with a computer. And I'm really going back to the past to think about how that felt the first time, and the sort of questions that we had then, the issues, because I think that like we're asking a lot of questions now that we have already asked and answered in many ways. And so a lot of these things, like, they come back, and or they're just below the surface and we don't notice. And so I think that like having these conversations about labor from the 1950s or computer advertising in the 1980s is really worth still having now, those conversations, because it can tell us a lot about where we are, like where we came from, to help us understand like what it is that we have in our hands now, but also, yeah, ways that we can build differently, ways that we can be more aware of everything that's going on, because everything's made to look really simple, but actually it's quite complex.
And on that note, as we are living through another moment of intense technological hype, like I said, AI, crypto, the metaverse, with promises that sound awfully familiar, what does your work with historical computing teach us about how to read today's tech promises?
You see the promises again and again. So we've had these promises before, and you can be like, did they live up to it? And we've also had the fears. Some fears are warranted, and some I think are not as scary as they seem. So even thinking about when sort of microprocessor stuff was happening, they, like the BBC in the UK ran a computer literacy program for the entire country, because everyone was scared that they were going to lose their jobs and factories were being taken over by robots. And some of that happened. But, you know, this programming was really about sort of reassuring people. It was teaching computers to people so that they could not be so worried, but also have a part in this sort of movement of time. And what we're living through now feels really similar to that for me. But, you know, I'm not entirely anti-AI or new technology, but I am very hesitant about it. And the thing I'm scared about is more how it's sort of being used by larger corporations, how it's sort of being understood by everybody, the conversations that are happening. I really wish that we had more open conversations about technology, that were a little more informed, not just through TikTok or, you know, I love TikTok, but not just through sort of TikTok or even government sort of messaging or corporate messaging. You know, I wish more people were, I guess, like in the library or in the lab or, you know, in the archives, and having a very engaged understanding of the past. I do sort of love, like, I'm not a big like nostalgia person, but I do love the sort of 2000s nostalgia that's been happening, because I'm seeing people thinking about flip phones, they're thinking about like MySpace, coding your MySpace website, and these things that I actually think were quite important to live through, because you kind of have a more sort of autonomous sort of connection to technology, even though obviously these are big corporations, but there was a sort of difference in these pasts to how we are now. And even if you think about like coding boot camps and things, that's sort of not really happening as much anymore, because AI is coming through. And so it's like, where are the, you know, learning opportunities for this, where it's a little bit more in community and in conversation, you know, hacker spaces and these sorts of things. And, you know, I come from like DIY zine making culture, and like these, I've found some spaces, there's like amazing groups and people doing it, but I guess I wish there was maybe a more wide sweeping way of engaging in this way, as opposed to just like having your iPad and clicking connect.
Mm-hmm. You've covered technologies from the 70s through the early 2000s, a period that's recent enough to feel familiar but distant enough to seem historical. And what's interesting about that liminal space?
Yeah, I mean, I remember the 2000s well, you know, I lived through them, but many people don't. And it's, you know, I remember when I was young and I would like go thrift shopping for clothes, and stuff from the 60s felt really, really old and cool. But actually it was only, you know, 30 years prior, and we're kind of in that space now, back to this moment of technology that for me feels like, yeah, part of my own memory. And it's sort of a nice moment for me, because it's all coming back with this sort of 2000s nostalgia that's happening at the moment. And I think that that's like a nice time period to sort of look back on, because it is a sort of recent memory. The artifacts are still quite accessible, and the sort of archiving of the site, websites and things are still there, some of it, on the Wayback Machine, if you want to go look. Can I say that? On the Wayback Machine that the Internet Archive run. And, you know, so it's like a little easier for, say, me to talk about this sort of stuff, and for other sort of younger people than me to understand. But then, like, you can work from that point and move backwards and be like, okay, well, what was right before that that led to this? And what was right before that that led to this? And so, like, that, from a storytelling perspective, is really useful, because you can see the link very easily. Whereas if you go back, even the work I was doing with switchboard operators, which was like early 1900s, late 1800s, through like 1920s, 1940s, that to me feels like a very sort of isolated story if I'm telling that story. And I obviously, like, I'm finding the links and I'm doing that work, and I find it fascinating. And I'm finding these links and being like, okay, well, this is connected with of Siri, and this is connected with, but I think that, like, with the podcast starting, particularly the cell phone season, it was really useful to talk about that, because you know, at that point in that season, we were talking a lot about how women were advertised to, and then how they used the technology, and also the idea of, like, fashion phones, and different types of obsolescence, whereas, like, now we have a lot of tech sort of obsolescence in terms of, you know, the iPhones all kind of look the same, but the software and that sort of, like, stops working, and your battery stops working and you get a new one. And we were sort of daydreaming a little bit about the phones from the sort of 90s and 2000s, or the 2000s, that were really interesting, and they were, like, different colors, and it was like you have different sort of clip-on things that match your outfits. And then we realized that's just aesthetic obsolescence. And it's exactly the same thing. It's just through a different, slightly different lens that, like, oh, if we can have it, the phones match the fashion cycles, then people will buy new phones. In the same way as now, it's like, oh, maybe if we have the cameras get slightly better, people will get new phones. And I remember at that point, I was like, I feel kind of, like, tricked a little bit, because I was thinking back on those times and those phones and being nostalgic, when we actually got under the hood of the story, we realized that we were sort of the audience for those ads and these sort of different cycles. And I think that, you know, particularly with the podcast, being able to bring our own memories to some of the stories was really helpful. And for the older, you know, the older stories that we looked at, we also would often be like, oh, this reminds me of this thing from when I was young. Yeah.
I had a bright pink one. I remember that.
Oh my God. Was it a razor? Motorola Razor? Like the flip one?
Yeah, the flip one. Exactly. One of my first ones. And then I had a, it was like early, not smartphone, but it was different. It was like from Microsoft. So it was like a very early Microsoft phone, and it was very unique and silver. But yeah, you're right. I never thought about that before. But still, they, you know, yeah, the, like, the iPhones, they keep pretty much the same design, but they still try to create, like, seasonal colors that will differentiate a little bit. At least you can tell if that's an older model of a newer model.
But yeah, I mean, it shows that you have the money and the capability to buy the newest phone if you get, like, the new orange one, regardless of whether you like orange or not. Everyone else will know.
Yes, it's so interesting. And you mentioned, like, you know, the podcasting itself is a medium with its own histories and politics. And what drew you to audio as the format for this work? And how does the conversational, episodic nature of podcasting shape how you tell these stories?
I think that, you know, Anna and I were, she lives in the UK, I live in America, in New York. I was in LA when we started the podcast, and we were working on this other project together, and it was all virtual. So I think when we were thinking about, like, how do we have these conversations, doing it sort of over the internet in some form was kind of the way the obvious way to do it. We also wanted it to be very accessible to people. We wanted it to be able to be archived in a certain way. Anna made a really amazing website for us where everything is stored. And yeah, and like I have a sort of slight radio background from my college years and really enjoy audio storytelling. And so it kind of worked that this idea kind of connected with audio, and I was looking for a project that was audio based. So that's why we went there. And, you know, I think it was a lot of work. Every episode took us so many hours because we were doing some original research, but also, you know, just going into deep archives of information and, you know, other researchers' work, but going into, you know, university sort of libraries and finding stuff and then working out how to tell a sort of narrative story based on the research. And yes, I'm a video artist, but the episode's like an hour long, so, you know, putting the work in to then make a like video version was too much for us, I guess. And we were really enjoying the audio component, and I think there's something about, yeah, just like being in someone's ear and that they can listen while they're doing other things, as opposed to sort of having someone sit down in front of a documentary, which is, you know, I make experimental documentaries, but it, for me, in my practice, these are kind of two separate aspects of my work.
In you've recently founded Structured Knowledge, which is a consultancy for helping people shape complex ideas into public-facing work. And what patterns do you see in how researchers and creatives struggle to communicate these ideas? And what does Structured Knowledge mean to you?
Yeah, so Structured Knowledge is, yeah, my new consultancy. I've been running for about a year, 8 months or so, I think now. But it's developmental editing, so sort of structural editing of manuscripts, and also kind of one-on-one project consulting, so for documentaries, podcasts, other forms of sort of creative work. And I think, you know, everything I've been saying around the journey that I took to kind of understand how art can be kind of in between. It can play an artistic role, and it can also play sort of a research role and connect to audiences, was something that I was noticing a lot of people were coming to me for support on their own projects with. And I think it's often about audience. It's about like, who are you telling the story to, and like, what do you want them to understand? So I work a lot with PhDs that have a dissertation they're turning into a book. And how do you think about, you have all of this research, and how are you going to turn it into something that will be really engaging for sort of the public to read? And it's really about like intention and audience. Like, what are you trying to say in a dissertation? You're often arguing a point, and you're giving examples, and you're showing sort of you're explaining the kind of landscape of research that your own work sits within. But within a book, you want to tell like an engaging narrative story a lot of the time that maybe will say the same sort of point at the end, but you're not pushing that point. You're maybe displaying that point through anecdotes and trivia, and then kind of weaving in the research part. So yeah, that sort of transition from research into narrative is what I do at Structured Knowledge. And for me, it's like it's kind of my methodology. So I have my artistic research practice, and then Structured Knowledge is my methodology. So it's like everything I use in my own practice, but I'm helping others to do it, because I'm passionate about research and history, and helping other researchers as well to be able to communicate their ideas. I think with the podcast particularly, and with all my work, I'm always going into the library and I'm finding all this incredible work that I didn't know about, and I feel like deserves to be seen more broadly. And sometimes it's just a slight different shift in intention and sort of understanding who your audience is, who you're telling these stories to, and like how they will receive the information.
In many of the technologies you studied, the project CyberSyn, Education of Computers, Community Networks, represented visions of computing that didn't win out. What do these discontinued, failed, discontinued technologies teach us about possibilities that still exist?
I think it teaches us that we have space to play and experiment and come up with hypotheses and test them, and that, yeah, that things that failed or ended, it wasn't necessarily the fault of the technology or the technologist, and it's actually kind of society and what's going on. But even that tells us something about the world that we're in and maybe the possibilities that we can adjust to. I think that, like, I really enjoy very broad speculative thinking of, like, oh, imagine if the world was not at all how it is, what could we do and what could we build? But also, the world kind of does exist how it exists. And I think the failure of some of these sort of initiatives also tells us about the constraints that we're working within. I think kind of having a sort of understanding of that means that we can see these little pockets that we can move towards, maybe that sort of dream future that we're building. So there's that, but then there's also just that, like, we have done such amazing things in sort of the last 100 years of computing, and we can do more. And yeah,
absolutely. And it's maddening to think, most people think of fate and we're living through fate, and the experience we have now was supposed to happen. But it's unimaginable for people that were living 50, 100, 200 years ago, or let's put 1,000 years ago. It is really an exercise of radical imagination to even place the world how it is today. I was seeing earlier this morning some photographs of old Boulder from years, decades ago, and everything looked so different. And I can only imagine some of these people in the photographs, just what would be their impression today. It's just so radically different. And it definitely makes us think of the choices we made, or actually the options that were imposed upon ourselves as we develop and question and ask questions and exercise this imagination. It's definitely a powerful tool in inventing the future ahead of us.
Yeah, I think that sort of radical imagining is really important. But also the baby steps can happen at the same time. And that it's not just about the conversation of what could we do, what could we fund, what could be the big future. It's like,
maybe plant some small seeds.
Plant some small seeds, or, you know, think about getting a different type of phone, or setting up a, you know, radio station of your own, or, you know, these little networks, these sort of fun things that you can do just with your friends or by yourself. These, like, they're radical as well. And if we're sort of doing that from the ground up while we're also dreaming about, like, all the different types of futures that we could build, that's, I think, how we get there, as opposed to just the dreaming. It's like the little seeds as well.
Maybe radical imagination and radical actions, yes, as well, all combined. And, you know, you work closely with the Media Archaeology Lab here at CU Boulder. And you mentioned, you know, maybe having a new phone, a different phone, making different choices. But what happens when you can physically touch and use old computers, old tech, rather than just reading about them? And how does materiality change understanding?
I mean, it makes it feel closer in time, like we were talking before. You know, it like makes that connection really fast, that you can go play with like an Apple II and understand how it feels. But also, you know, like there's a big sort of table of old phones at the lab, and I saw students go in and just be like, oh my God, what's this? What's this? You know, flip open the Motorola Razr and sort of see the buttons that you have to actually press and sort of play video games on like 20 different consoles. And it just, I don't know, it goes into your brain a little bit and you're like, oh, there was more than just like the two consoles that we use now. There's like all of these different formats of media as well. And I think it makes you realize that, oh, like things change over time, and where we're in now isn't the current state, like set state. It's going to change and things are going to move, and like in that movement there's room for possibility.
For me, visiting the lab was also understanding, well, there's so much more than computers and phones, so many other mediums.
Yeah.
And older tech that I've never heard of, but like I said, at some point that shaped the way people communicated, how people worked, how people lived their lives, and it just, in a way, they're embedded in our machines today, but they were developed at some point to solve, to answer a question and solve a need. And it's just interesting to see how diverse that used to be in so many, many, many different machines. You know, who are some contemporary thinkers, artists, or projects doing work that excites you? And where do you see the most interesting questions being asked about technology and society right now?
I think I'm very lucky to be in New York. At the moment, I've been there for 5 years, and I'm in some amazing communities there. I think, you know, my community at the New Museum, the New Inc. Art and Tech Incubator has been incredible. I did a year in their Art and Code cohort and am now a community member, and there's so many amazing projects that are happening there, and particularly projects that are looking at community building and like ways of being with technology. And I do some work with Rhizome there as well, that do a lot of amazing work conserving older net-based artworks, and also presenting newer works as well, that sort of engage with these pasts. And I think that I found a lot of amazing sort of artists and community around these sort of institutions that are often sort of smaller. But I think that a lot of this work happens in community with others. And so these sort of spaces are really important to have these discussions and feel kind of engaged in the world of this sort of practice. Because it can be a little, lonely, but you get very like into a very sort of niche part of tech history, and then you kind of forget the rest of the world, and then you meet other people that are also doing it. You're like, oh, I was looking at this and I was looking at this, and it's sort of, yeah, and that sort of brings up new ideas and projects. And a lot of the work is also collaborative, that there's like multiple people working on projects together, and I love it.
And if someone listening wants to start excavating their own technological memories or local computing histories, where should they begin, and what archives or methods would you recommend?
I mean, I think the local library is always a great resource, and there's often like, I don't know, groups that meet up or workshops, local universities, your parents' like tech box that has a million cords that you don't know what they connect with, like go and look and see what those connections are, because even I do that in my own box. I'm like, what's this? Like, what does this connect? What does this charge? And just like following those threads and seeing what's around you in your community and in your home and in your family, and starting there and then kind of like building out from that, I think is the way to go.
That's great advice. And, you know, one last question, what's next for you in your project? Oh,
well, I'm at the lab, right, the Media Archaeology Lab right now, and I'm working on a project about roses in computer advertising in the 1980s, and thinking about this symbol that kept showing up for me when I was looking at magazines. And I'm making a video piece through, I'm a resident at Brick, which is a space in Brooklyn that has like a community television station, and among many other things. So I'm there for a year that started this past October, making a sort of experimental documentary about the research on the rose. And I have a show in Kentucky next year that's looking at that work. And I have some other sort of Chilean political projects coming up that I'm not ready to talk about, but I'm sort of in research stage.
Can't wait for that to be ready. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. This was fascinating. And keep in tune with Looks Like New.
Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks all the questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the fourth Thursday of every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.